we present the News Quiz with your host, Miles Jupp.
Hello, and welcome to the News Quiz. We start with a cutting from a technology blog read by Neil Sleet.
A professional cyclist has been banned for 6 years after it was discovered she was racing with a hidden electric motor. Femke van den Driessen was caught at the World Championships in January during an inspection of her pit area.
Our thanks to James Richards for painstakingly hunting down that muck and indeed having that effect on Neil Sleet. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first on my right, Andy Hamilton and Vicky Pepperdine? And opposite them on my left, Zoe Lyons and Susan Kalman. So, Andy, who were found in law to have been treated unlawfully?
Well, this is the story that's been dominating the week. Obviously, the very tragic events of 27 years ago at Hillsborough. So it's been a week of fairly grim TV coverage. And I've watched a procession of the great and the good appearing on TV to express regret and sympathy and what have you. And I've been watching this for sort of a few hours. And then on my television appeared Kelvin McKenzie. And I watched fascinated as Kelvin started to explain that because he had been hoodwinked by the lies of South Yorkshire police that made him do that infamous headline, because he'd been hoodwinked by the police, that he too, Kelvin McKenzie, was one of the victims of the Hillsborough disaster. And as I watched him saying this, I very nearly lost my lunch. I think it was probably the most nauseating public statement I've ever seen. In fact, to be honest, I watched the rest of the news from the toilet in case Kelvin came back on. I didn't want to risk it. But he made various regret-like noises, you know, and he expressed his sympathy for the families, and he was contrite, which, interestingly, is a combination of con and trite. But if you examine what Kelvin actually did on that fateful morning, he printed a front page with the banner headline, "The Truth." I think if you put "the truth," you probably, as a journalist, ought to try and check whether it is the truth. Now, nobody believed that story about fans urinating on dead bodies and stuff like that. Nobody else printed it. Even Kelvin's own staff didn't believe it. The only person in Britain who was prepared to believe that story was Kelvin, and he believed it because he wanted to believe it, because it conformed with his prejudices, because, you know, he was part of a newspaper that at the time was very much in cahoots with the Thatcher government, which in turn had sort of turned the police force into a private army, and the Sun had developed a fantastically unhealthy relationship with the police. Not something they do nowadays, of course. So I think that was a particular low point. The other low point, I thought, was Cerean Blair. Now, you may remember Cerean Blair. He was chief of the Met, and he didn't cover himself in glory in terms of police transparency after the death of Jean de Menezes, but he said he began by quoting that rather sort of over-quoted cliche about the past being another country. And he then went on to say that the cover-up could never happen again. And I thought, I sat there listening to it, I thought, the one way to ensure that a cover-up like that doesn't happen again is not to think that it can't happen again. I mean, basically, he was sitting there saying, complacency can't happen to us.
The thing that I found, it wasn't even astonishing that the day after the report came out, it was on the front page of all of the newspapers apart from two newspapers, The Sun and The Times. The Times changed their second edition after people said this is wrong, but The Sun had a small section in which said, "We've apologised before and we do it again." Tiny little section. Now, I play a game with my niece, who's four, where we put our hands up in front of our face and we pretend we're not there, right? And I go, "Oh, I can't see you. You're not there." And she's a child. So only someone with an infant's brain would believe that that works, to just pretend nothing has happened. And I think, personally, the most disgraceful thing that happened this week was that the son essentially ignored what had happened. Yes, you've apologised before, but apologise again. And do you know what? Keep apologising and put it on your front page. Don't put it in page 5 or 7 and a tiny thing. Apologise unreservedly on the front page. And do you know what? I would like that on the front page of The Sun until it's shut down because no one buys it any longer.
Finally, the Hillsborough campaigners received some measure of justice this week when a jury ruled the 96 victims of the disaster had been unlawfully killed. At least this is as close as this story can come to a happy ending, short of those responsible for the cover-up receiving custodial sentences, preferably in a jail in Liverpool where the cell doors are left mysteriously unlocked on a nightly basis. During the course of the inquest, South Yorkshire police tried to blame drunken fans, supporters without tickets, and pretty much everyone, in fact, except the Freemasons. And I cannot imagine why that might be, but perhaps I'll ask the chaps next time I'm down the lodge. The verdict did contain its fair share of surprises, though. For example, who would have thought that Kelvin McKenzie, Sir Bernard Ingham and Boris Johnson aren't the purveyors of factual accuracy we always fondly assumed them to be? David Cameron hailed this as a momentous day for justice and a great day for his beloved West Ham. The Sun's first front page didn't mention Hillsborough at all, preferring to concentrate on whether Jay-Z has had an affair with somebody called Rita Ora, no doubt kicking off another 27-year search for the truth. 2 points to Andy. Vicky, who didn't emerge to deal with emergencies?
Ah, yes, OK. So this is the junior doctors who, of course, were on strike 2 days this week over the imposition of a contract, which actually some say is illegal, but which is widely disputed and which the junior doctors do not wish to conform to. Hence, walking out in a historic moment of the first time that doctors have ever stroked. Yes. That's a medical term. You may or may not be familiar with. I'm trained as a doctor. But anyway, yes, they stroked last week. So I think that's probably my answer. I'm going to go home now.
I walked past a group of stroking junior... I wish they'd been stroking me. I walked past, a group of striking junior doctors. I'm slightly disappointed, Miles, because I read some of the newspapers and the Daily Mail, and it's... It said on the front cover something like, "Don't get sick today, everyone's going to die." And I walked past a group of striking junior doctors and I expected them to be, you know, wielding chainsaws and actually taking people out from the press cupboard. I thought actually the point was they were going to actually actively try and kill more of us to make their point. And they just seemed perfectly nice people. One complaint, if I may register it in public, I got a sticker from a handsome young man. And it fell off within 3 paces, Miles. So that's my one complaint about
it's
the
It's hard to trust people who rely on weak adhesive, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it literally stuck on. I said, "Good luck to you." Walked off. Off it fell. And I thought, well, I don't know how I feel about you now. Your stickers are rubbish.
To be honest, the doctor's strike doesn't affect me because I'm a hypochondriac. I diagnosed myself. That's right. I've currently got Zika virus. I'm not making a fuss. I'm being a little soldier. But Hunt said, on more than one occasion now, that the problem is that the doctors don't understand the contract they've been offered. Now, if what he's saying is they can't understand this contract, surely that means they're too stupid to be doctors. Of course, I think they do understand it, and I think they recognise the thin end of a very long wedge. But if he genuinely believes they don't have the wit, as he put it, to understand it, he should probably, you know, clear the doctors out. And I mean, I don't know how far he's going to push it now. You know, he's kind of painted himself into a corner. Yeah. Whether he goes the whole kind down the miners' strike type route and we have mounted policemen charging down corridors, you know, escorting doctors who've been bussed in from Lithuania, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some confusion about who these junior doctors are, because I think they sound like junior doctor sounds, they're all about 10. And I think there's a sort of confusion that people think they're sort of student doctors and they want a bit more money and they don't want to work on a Saturday because they want to go to that party that Chris is having. You know, but actually, of course, the reality is that 50% of the medical people within the health service, i.e. the doctors, are junior doctors. So you've been sort of training for 15 years and you'd still be called a junior doctor and you would still be put on this sort of contract where you have to agree to lots of things. And if you're a woman, you have to suffer the sort of disadvantage if you have a child, and particularly if you're a lone parent. And I think the government have said, you know, while they recognise that this contract may disadvantage lone parents, it may benefit other women, e.g. those who have partners. So I think basically what they're saying is stop looking at those boring old medical textbooks and get yourself a bloody boyfriend.
But that's the question is what's going to happen next, because the next step is an indefinite strike. And I may have misheard, but the only thing that really did make me laugh was I was listening to an interview with the junior doctor, and the interviewer said, what are you going to do next? And she said, well, I don't know, we've got lots of choices. I might move abroad, somewhere like Scotland. You people in England really have no idea where I live.
Well, I think Chris Grayling has stepped in, hasn't he? He has said that he thinks that if we don't stay in the EU, the money we'll save will pay for these blooming junior doctors and their Saturday night freakouts. So, you know, I mean, my feeling is that actually if the government had just invested their parents' money a bit more wisely, you know, perhaps onshore... So just to be really radical, then, you know, perhaps we could have afforded all these demands that these people are making.
It's approaching that beautiful time in the European referendum, though, where everything is about Europe. So if we left Europe, there wouldn't be a junior doctor strike. And you'll see this more and more as we approach the exciting apex of referendum panic. So, for example, this week, Miles, it was snowing. Do you know that?
Yes, well aware.
If we left Europe, that wouldn't happen. Because do you know what would happen? We would have British workers building as a shield against the weather from Europe.
To be fair, it did look like French snow.
It did.
It was sort of half-arsed, wasn't
it? Yeah. And there was a four-hour gap at lunchtime, yeah.
Of homeopathy, isn't he, Jeremy?
For real?
He's a big advocate of homeopathy, alternative medicine, which I'm sorry if there are any crystal danglers in the room, but not having it. I always think with alternative medicine, you know, if you're prepared to use it for the little stuff, you should have enough faith in it to use it for the big stuff as well. That's what I think. But then when you think about that, you think, well, how many herbalist ambulances do you ever see? Working towards the scene of an incident.
I think they cycle, to be fair.
They cycle. To
that's
shake
mean,
a
sorry.
Tin of mung beans to get people out the way. Emergency! Waving a sage over a broken leg. There you go.
Maybe that's what he's doing. He wants us to move towards a homeopathic health service where you don't actually have a hospital, you just have the memory of a hospital.
Memorably, junior doctors in England have been on strike this week in response to a new contract which will see a change to what constitutes unsociable hours. In the region of 125,000 operations and outpatients appointments were cancelled this week. Operations do get cancelled all the time, of course, due to unexpected absences, sudden complications, or simply the surgeon touching the edge with his pliers so that the patient's nose lights up. The strikes have gathered momentum since Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt unveiled the new contract with longer working hours and new white coats with Sports Direct written on the back. Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt has refused to back down, although in an interview this week said that this was likely to be his last job in politics. So, well done, doctors. Whatever happens, this hasn't all been in vain. 2 points to Vicky. Zoe, which high street store has been left rummaging for cash down the back of the sofas in its own furniture department, conveniently located next to lighting?
This is British Home Stores, BHS, has sadly gone into administration after 88 years on our high streets. I know, and it's sort of part of our lives, isn't it? It feels like a friend leaving. I mean, most people will have at some point felt the comfort and warmth of a Winsiette nightie bought at BHS, warm because of its fleecy material and because they were highly flammable. And it's gone into administration, which is terribly tragic. But sort of as a sideline to this is the sort of backstory of the business behind it. The business was owned by Sir Philip Green. He bought it for 200 million quid 15 years ago and sold it for £1 last year, which sounds like a pretty rubbish deal. Sounds like something I'd have done. But, oh, yeah, I mean, for £1. But in the 15 years that he owned it, he managed to siphon off 400 million quid's worth of dividends to himself and his family, which is quite a substantial amount. And when he sold the business for £1, it had accrued a deficit in its pension fund of over £500 million. Now, you're thinking, well, at least he sold the dividends for 400 million quid. We probably got the income tax on that. No, mate, no, we didn't. Because, cleverly, his wife, Tina, lives in Monaco, and she's the sole shareholder of the business. All goes through her books. Not a penny of tax paid on that either. Oh, what a shame. And he seems like such a likeable character, doesn't he?
How is this going to affect you, Andy? Where will you be heading for winter wear and the like now?
No, they had a big children's department. That came in handy. Thank you. Sir Philip Green. What amuses me is this guy was kind of sucked up to by so many politicians. They get very starstruck by any businessman who makes a bit of money. And so Tony Blair knighted him and said he was a visionary, and Cameron took him on as an efficiency and savings czar, which, as Zoe illustrated, you know, he very efficiently saved himself a couple of hundred million in tax. But you kind of think, it's not that brilliant. You don't need to be a genius to do what he did. You know, I mean, putting stuff in your wife's name and sending it to Monaco, that's page one of the tax avoidance manual.
The big bumper book of tax efficiency.
The big bumper book of tax efficiency for tax efficient wealth generators.
It's always sad though, because it's a bit like when Woolies went and Comet and all of those. And then they always interview people on the telly, don't they, in the high street, and they go, oh, I'll really miss it. I'll really, really miss it. And they'll go, when were you last in there? Oh, I haven't been in there for years. Do you want me shopping online now? You know, it's funny. It's almost like there's a connection between me not being able to leave my sofa and get out of my onesie and just click away on my iPad and the shop's all shut in.
It used to be a treat to go to BHS, to go to the cafe at BHS. They had the best macaroni cheese. So for a treat, we would go to the BHS cafe.
The Calman family, or
yeah, as a family, we'd go. Why are you looking at me like that?
I was trying to. No,
it's like the Scottish version of Angela's Ashes. It was a macaroni. One plate, four spoons.
What is that? Had your gamekeeper helping you, Miles, but for us it was a treat to go to BHS.
I was when I looked at you, whatever way I looked at it, I was just trying to help build up a picture in my mind.
You were looking at me like people went to BHS.
I've eaten in several BHS cafes, Susan. You mustn't take this sort of attitude. It's very unbecoming.
I'm saying it's a fond memory which has now been sullied by class distinctions. Which appear to have been levelled at me by Miles Jupp.
No, I can completely understand where you're coming from. As a treat, we used to be taken to the opera. So don't imagine I don't know what it's like being you, Susan. Consequentially, this is the collapse of British Home Stores, once as familiar a presence on our nation's high streets as public drunkenness and a boarded-up branch of Blockbuster Video. Former BHS owner Sir Philip Green declined to comment on the whereabouts of the missing money, speaking on the deck of his new 91-metre, £100 million yacht. Green bought the yacht last year, but seems to have forgotten the first rule of business. You're supposed to fall off the yacht before people discover the hole in the pension fund. There are suggestions...
This is like a trip down memory lane. We were doing Drop the Dead Donkey when Robert Maxwell fell off his yacht, and we'd built a whole plot line around Robert Maxwell. So he very selfishly created a huge amount of extra work for me.
On top of everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I expect this is all ultimately the order of things. Woolworths goes, BHS follows, in the UK returns to woodland, nature's slow but ineluctable fingers, clearing the sylvan soil from the pernicious legacy of mankind, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. 2 points. To Zoe. Susan, whose race row has left them red-faced?
So, the thing about this story is... I became aware of it this week when I was footing about on the internet, and I saw the following tweet. Just a reminder that, so far as we know, Ken Livingstone is still locked in a disabled toilet while journalists shout questions about Hitler. Now... My initial thought was, I know the BBC's in trouble, but that is not a good idea for a game show. What it turned out was, there was a row that started about Naz Shah's Facebook comments, which were considered anti-Semitic. And she had apologised and suspended. Then, like a guardian of joy, Ken Livingstone rode into the frame. And he made some comments about Hitler, basically as a way of distracting from Naz Shah. He made some comments about Hitler, which is a curious thing. It's like trying to distract from a discussion about racism by saying how much good the Ku Klux Klan does. Keep laundries going. And... there is a car crash of an interview on the Daily Politics with Ken Livingstone, after which he was suspended from the Labour Party. Then, just when things couldn't get any better... perpetually aggrieved haggis in a hat George Galloway popped up to say, this is all a coup against Corbyn. All this anti-Semitic stuff's all made up because everyone's after Jeremy Corbyn. And I was watching the news. I was fascinated by this amazing story unfolding in front of my eyes. And the telling thing was that someone on the BBC News said, if we hear from Jeremy Corbyn, we'll let you know. And that, unfortunately, is the point of this story, as far as I'm concerned. A lot of people in this country would like there to be an opposition party, because the Conservatives are currently unopposed, because they're all fighting with each other. Ken Livingstone writes in and talks about Hitler. You don't talk about Hitler in any good way. There is no good way to start a sentence, well, Hitler said... It's like the first rule of Hitler Club.
It feels like, you know, Livingstone and people on the far left are just painting themselves into more and more complicated corners.
And toilets.
I think it's just disgraceful that he's hiding in a disabled toilet when they're...
Yeah.
Unless
it could have been a disabled anti-Semite who wanted to use that facility.
Precisely, this is the latest cluster fudge to engulf the Game of Thrones mid-season bloodbath that is the Labour Party. Ken Livingstone has been suspended for his comments about Israel because it turns out that when your party is facing accusations of widespread anti-Semitism that are inflaming strong emotions on all sides, wading in and repeatedly shouting Hitler-supported Zionism astonishingly fails to calm things down. The suspension of Bradford West MP Naz Shah on Wednesday for allegedly anti-Semitic comments she made on Facebook opened less a can of worms and more a shipping container full of snakes. Livingstone pointed out that anti-Semitic attacks had declined in London when he was mayor. Don't know what point he was trying to make there, that he was too busy, perhaps? In many ways, it's been the worst day for the Labour Party since October 1948, when David and Naomi Corbyn decided to make up after their spat about the ration book. 2 points to Susan. And at the end of round one, the scores are Zoe and Susan have 6, but Andy and Vicky have 7. We start round two with something heard on Tuesday's Radio 4 morning news bulletin.
A new study suggests that being given a flu jab in the morning is more effective than being given one in the afternoon.
And our thanks to Neil Sleet for reading that out earlier in the week and then immediately sending it in to me asking if he could read it out again. On this programme. Andy, which bong is taking a hit?
Well, the Palace of Westminster is falling into terrible disrepair. I mean, it's a horrific problem. The structure is completely compromised. There's cracks appearing everywhere. The beams are rotten and there's brickwork decaying. And basically the whole of the Houses of Parliament is turning into one giant metaphor. And part of this problem is Big Ben, which, you know, has been getting pretty decrepit for quite some time. They've finally decided that if they don't go in now and fix it, it'll be a real problem. And it won't sound for several months during the 3-year renovation of the Elizabeth Tower. So that means that the ITN newsreaders will have to do their own bongs. So that sounds like a different story, doesn't it? I think if they're going to do it, they should just completely refresh it and renovate it, do something different with it. Do it. Like when I was a kid, I used to go to the Battersea Fun Fair when I was tiny, and there was a thing called the Mackeson clock. And on the hour, a huge model of a toucan used to come out and go, "Rah!" I think that's what we want. Scare the hell out of the tourists as well. 30-foot-high toucan.
Just coming, one coming out of each face of the clock, do you think?
Just cut. Yeah, that's 4. Yeah. You don't see those clocks around in the UK much now, do you? Those sort of novelty clocks.
No.
Yes, we've lost so much, haven't we?
I'm quite pleased it's going to stop. I have a, I don't know if anyone knows this, I've got a phobia of clocks.
Oh, Christ.
You're misspelling that, Susan.
Well, I've had a lovely day out today. I hate clocks.
Is that just not called being late?
No. No, it's not the time thing. I'm always on time. I have a phobia of a certain type of clocks. I have a phobia of ticking clocks. I can't have anything ticking in my house or near me. And so if I go into, like, a hotel and there's a clock, I take the clock off the wall and take the batteries out. And if I can't take the batteries out, I put them in a drawer and cover it with loads of blankets because I can't sleep if I hear ticking at all. I can't have ticking. I bought 1930s big grandfather clock that doesn't work. It just sits in the hall, but I refuse to put it on because it'll tick, which was a slightly stupid purchase. But, I mean... I can't stand ticking of clocks at all.
I don't know what my face looked like when you were talking about BHS, but right now...
It's terrifying. Don't you find... I find
this
ticking
behavior,
clocks...
This sounds like the sort of thing if you were watching a film about a sort of hitman or a serial killer or something. That's the sort of thing they do when they checked into a hotel room. It sounds...
Well, the thing is that sometimes when...
Very wrong.
The last time I checked into a hotel and I hit the clock, the next day I came in and they bought a bigger clock because they thought... They couldn't find the clock, so they bought a bigger clock, a more ticky clock. And I was like, no, so I have to...
This happened every day for a week, so you eventually had a massive clock.
I had Big Ben in my room. So I'm quite happy because I find... It's horrible.
Is it only the noise? Can you bear the visuals of a clock?
I can bear that. That's why I've got a clock in my house that doesn't work, and I don't mind seeing the hands of a clock, but it's when I know the hands are turning that I find myself feeling frightened.
And is this...
Have so you what shared about it? Your watch? What's, you know...
This doesn't work.
So you live outside time, essentially.
Yes, essentially. You should share this with people more qualified than us, Susan.
Such an unusual. A lot of people don't like ticking clocks. Someone in the audience, does anyone here not like ticking clocks? Yeah. Look at that. There's some other weirdos over there.
I've got ticking clocks in my house, and when people stay over, they do take the batteries out.
Yes.
Yeah. But I quite like
You're
the soothing.
Why? It's not soothing. It means
quite
death.
Like does it?
Is that why you think that it's bonking every second on the head?
It's not.
Born? That's
it's
a Dickens.
No, I don't. No, it's not that
death.
I feel it's closer to. It's not that I feel that I'm closer to death. I feel it. I can't stand silence. It's terrifying. Because in silence, there's danger. Oh my God, I'm
So is it like the silence between the ticks that's actually the problem?
The suspense is killing her. That's with respect, Susan, I can't recall ever hearing Big Ben tick. Let it go bong on the hour and half hour, but I can't remember it. It doesn't sort of sit there going tick, tock, tick. I didn't mean to do that. Sorry.
Okay, we've lost one.
Not deliberate. Yeah, okay.
Woman down.
Can we get first aid down here, please? Well, weirdly, they said that the clock will sound on special occasions, and I don't know what a clock's definition of a special occasion. Probably being in a room with Susan, I would say.
It'd be great if they just changed the chimes to a beep, 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 beep.
Yeah. Maybe go digital, not analog. Yeah.
Apple Watch up there.
Yeah.
iBen.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just... When I talk about these things, I... They don't sound weird until I say them, and then like you'll sit there like, what? And I'm like, these are it's a normal thing to
Also, Miles doesn't show you enough respect when you share these things with
that's
us.
That's true.
Do you?
Oh, I don't no, I mean I hope that I'm creating a sort of supportive environment, Susan. I mean I don't want you to think that you shouldn't share these sort of demented things with us. That's absolutely the last thing. You're not being judged by us normal people. You must never think that.
So which is worse, the fear of cocks or the fear of clocks?
Should we take this in order?
I can take the battery out of my clock.
Was ticking, wouldn't you?
What is anybody talking about?
Well, that's 20 unbroadcastable minutes.
At least.
Rabbit, oh. No.
This is going to sound very puzzling at home. Lots of silence.
Yeah, sorry,
you can edit out.
Didn't mean to frighten you there, Susan.
Oh, dear.
Ravishingly, this is the... I can't do this. Ravishingly, this is the upcoming renovation of Big Ben, the UK's fourth favourite bell after Ian, Alexander Graham and Baby. Big Ben will be out of action for several months, where he's going to spend more time in the garden, hit the after-dinner circuit with William Hague, and write that novel he's always had inside him, Confessions of a Giant Ceremonial Bell. Still, one man's sabbatical is another man's opportunity. It's time for one of the smaller bells to step up to the plate. This is medium-sized Keith's chance to shine. Big Ben's chimes are usually broadcast live on Radio 4 every night at the start of the 6 o'clock news. Always worth listening out for to see if you can make out the sound of some pigeons misbehaving or the plaintive cries of Prince Frederick, the deformed elder brother of Prince Charles, calling out for his mother from the remote and Cogfield prison. It's been rumoured that the repairs are just a cover story and Big Ben is in fact being silenced because it knows too much. about the recent mystery celebrity threesome and the Freemasons. 2 points to Andy. Zoe, whose decision seems a little sketchy?
This is the V&A Museum in London, who have decided that, as well as not being able to photograph certain exhibits, museum goers are no longer going to be able to sketch them as well, which seems quite mean. They've said they can, you can still sketch the permanent exhibits. It's the temporary exhibits they don't want sketched, and they're sort of blaming loan restrictions and congestion around the exhibits, because you know what it's like if you go and see something and somebody sets up an easel in front of it and sketches away, and then somebody comes along and gets confused and think it's part of the installation and sets up an easel behind the person with an easel. And then before you know it, you're actually living an Escher painting. So... to me so many times. This particular ban on sketching is to do with an exhibit about underwear through the ages, which is what I often say to myself as I'm rummaging through my own kex drawer. It's called Undressed, A Brief History of Underwear, and it covers you little bits from the 18th century up to present day, but there's going to be no sketching of said pants, which is a little mean.
What if I turned up in my pants with a friend who sketched me, so I wasn't part of the exhibition, but I was wearing underwear from the ages?
Well, how old is too old, though?
Well,
when
my pooling pants, which I still have, are from 1999.
Wow.
They've got a few holes.
That's so you can get your legs in.
I mean, I did read quite a funny thing about this, which was that the director of the visitor experience at the V&A said it's one of the great joys of visiting the museum is to stumble across people drawing.
Do you know what? I don't really do museums because I haven't got the feet for it. Because you can walk for 45 minutes in a museum and your feet are killing you, like you've done 10 miles.
They need travelators past the big exhibits, don't they? Just sort of, oh, you know.
Yeah, yeah. They've got that at the Bio Tapestry, haven't they?
Have they? Little,
yeah. No. Yes, it's a. I think it's moving pretty slowly, but it is...
Do you move or does the tapestry move?
Yeah, yeah. You wait
pretty easy, wouldn't it?
The same bit comes round again. It's right.
Oh, he's got one in the eye again. Yeah.
No, you move. You move. From memory, I'm pretty sure that.
Is that true?
I think so.
True? Are you thinking about going to a sort of sushi restaurant?
Not all my memories. Do you think I've confused a sushi restaurant with the Via Tapestry?
Well, maybe you went to it when you were very tired. You've been wandering around. Your feet were hurting. Got to take a bit of weight off, sat on the conveyor belt.
My wife is down there.
Oh.
Was there a moving? Is that a false memory syndrome thing or?
It is false.
Hang on. Hang on. That's not my wife. Well, then I've misremembered.
Where was it?
I'm pretty sure. Listen, you strange woman. I don't. Oh, I remember now. I was on roller skates.
Aggravatingly, this is the V&A's decision...
I'm wondering how much of my life is wrong now.
Are there any other very strong, vivid recollections you've got of things that you... Now that you're really stopping to think, it might just not be the case.
I'm seeing a clock with a toucan. And I'm wondering now whether that existed.
Aggravatingly, this is the V&A's decision to ban visitors from sketching. This edict applies to two exhibitions, an exhibition of ladies' underwear and an exhibition of Botticelli. This is the thin end of the wedge. Next thing they'll be saying, you can't sit in a doctor's waiting room drawing pictures of your fellow patients. And that, frankly, is a Britain I do not wish to live in. I've spent many happy hours sketching in museums, and then, of course, there's my series of drawings of the menswear section of BHS. Once considered weird, now a priceless memento of a time gone by. 2 points to Zoe. Before we reveal the final scores, has anybody got a cutting they would like to share? Andy.
Yes, I've got... What I love about this cutting is I think it's just the most wonderfully English thing. It was sent in by Trevor Robertson, who saw this on the Worthing Street Life message board. And it says, "Hi all, just to make you aware, that the snakes up at Cissbury have started to wake up, as my one-year-old was bitten by one today at the top of the ring somewhere. Luckily, so far, he's OK. Just be aware. Thanks.
And the top of the ring is...
Vicky Pepperdine.
Yes, thank you. I have one which somebody called Jeremy Clark received this spam email with the subject line, lowest rates on burial insurance, cover yourself.
Zoe.
This was sent in by Julian Stubbins in Swansea, and it's taken from the South Wales Evening Post website. A gang who stole £20,000 worth of jammy dodgers and wagon wheels from a Welsh biscuit factory have been jailed. Some of the gang members shouted, "Anyone want a biscuit?" as they were taken down to their cells.
Susan.
This is details of a seminar being held at Leeds University sent in by Jennifer Blakey. Please go to Seminar Room 1 for the Erotic Anxieties and Erotic Transgression Seminar. Nibbles will be available throughout.
Thank you. And now let's take a look at the final score. Zoe and Susan have 10, but this week's winners are Andy and Vicky with 11. Before we leave you, here is a TV listing from The Telegraph, sent in by Bruce McWilson.
BBC Two at 9 p.m. Tribes, Predators and Me. A programme where Gordon Buchanan learns to hunt crocodiles with his bare hands. Last in the series.
And with that, goodbye!
Taking part in the news quiz were Andy Hamilton, Vicky Pepperdine, Zoe Lyons and Susan Kalman. In the chair was Miles Jupp, and the news was read by me, Neil Sweet. The chair's script was written by Gareth Gwynn, John Hunter and James Kettle, with additional material by Sarah Campbell and Rose Johnson. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC Radio Comedy production.